a few quick points. So, and I appreciate what you said about plain language. Do you not? I mean, I've been to one of the new ones and a few of the transitional appeals. Mm-hmm. But we always, in our case, have a little bit of statutory interpretation, just really basic stuff, and the Interpretation Act. In any cases, like mm-hmm. the Grace case. About income assistance supposed to be alleviating suffering, poverty suffering, mm-hmm. and neglect. Mm-hmm. And we use those cases. Mm-hmm. So this exact model, of, you know, quoting Iacobucci and all of that, has been used in Victoria again mm-hmm. and again and again, even in the transitional appeals. And we've been using that. Would you recommend still using the Interpretation Act in these other cases?
Oh, as most well definitely. Yeah. Sorry. Most definitely. Mm-hmm. Just because I think that the reasonableness standard should be defined plainly and that we shouldn't go down this path. If the ministry is presenting, mm-hmm. I think that this is really for the group to talk about. My gut feeling is you make one argument about how this is unfair and mm-hmm. these kinds of arguments should not be made here, mm-hmm. but then you argue them.
Right.
And okay. that's where you need legislation and that's yeah. where you need case law. And, you know, I don't know how we're going to do that. As community advocates.
And just my second part is the tribunal, I don't know the result, I'm hoping to find out later today, but it was on the monthly nutritional supplement.
Oh, yeah.
And the tricky area was around caloric supplementation, and the physician had indicated that caloric supplementation or food in addition to the regular diet was required for imminent danger to life. Mm-hmm. That was checked, satisfied the legislation, yeah. but then down below that on the form it says it requires for the physician to list what extra items are required.
Yeah.
And so that's policy, it's not legislation, but it was a tricky area, and I found that the members of the appeal panel knew nothing about income assistance. They stopped halfway through and a man said, "Are you telling me that there's a difference in the rate of money between an income assistance and a disability recipient?" And then actually another member of the same panel said, "Are you trying to suggest that a carrot is in addition to a regular diet?" And, you know, just taking where and saying, you know, actually fresh produce, because the physician had I'm almost finished. The physician had indicated that the person required a certain level of protein and fresh produce, fresh produce and something else, and the tribunal couldn't accept that fresh produce wasn't an average part of the diet of people on disability benefits. So anyway, this is what I just wondered in terms of reasonable dealing with that section of the form. Well,
can
anyway,
I think about that one?
Yes, of
and
course.
Maybe other people can think about that as well.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Well, actually, part of what I was going to say was just talked about, but I'll say it anyway. I agree with you that we should do everything we can to argue the plain meaning of mm-hmm. reasonableness as opposed to the reasonable standard of review. But I also do agree that we have to be prepared for both. So we really still do have to get our ducks in a row as far as this hideous standard of review stuff. Obviously, it's happening. And in that regard, I just want to point out to people that let's not take this example of this DS's submission on the standard of review as a given here, because I'm very familiar with the Baker case that's quoted in here. And this case has been misinterpreted and misconstrued. So we can rework this.
If I could also just speak to that.
Mm-hmm. And we can rework this and put it in a way that more benefits our clients, because they've obviously clearly interpreted in their way, okay?
The reason why I actually faxed this to Terrell was because at the tribunal that I represented someone at, they were told, the tribunal panel was told, and as well I was told that this was a form document where and it was to be used throughout the province, and that workers would just fill in the blanks, but these arguments were going to, this was what it was, just change the name and the issue under appeal, basically. So obviously it's being used in Victoria. I don't know if it's being used in other parts, but I think we need to, you know, it's a pretty crummy document.
Although I have to say, in Region 4 where I work, I've never seen this document. In fact, I'm quite impressed that the ministry puts absolutely no effort into their submissions. The first The first one or two that I did, I saw, you know, sort of the transitional stuff happening and a bit of background on the client, and that was it. And in the last couple that I've done, they haven't even bothered doing that. They just bring the reconsideration package with them and throw it on the table. So just so that you know, that may not necessarily be something you see in the tribunals, because I know I haven't seen it in any of mine.
Maybe I could just add to that as well. In discussions with people in Region 1 in the ministry, I was told, and it made a lot of sense to me, why would the ministry have a further tribunal submission? The recon is their decision. Like, what more does the ministry have to say? And another point, just following up on Christina's around, and a number of people's, how some kind of argument needs to be mounted that can counter this potential template. Also, not just a legal argument, but also lobbying, because the ministry should be publicly disgraced about this document if it's being used, quite frankly.
Skylar, could we have your question, and then I'd like to ask Vicky and Soraya to just talk a little bit about some of their experiences, and then more of you.
And I'm hoping that actually that you guys will be able to speak to these ideas, because they're experiments on my part. One is what we've been doing out of our office is a cover letter with the notice of appeal, and it says, "Dear Brian Gifford, blah, blah, blah." And we explain about natural justice and the principles of and full hearing and so on. Make sure that he knows that 2 days' notice is not sufficient for this client, and we fill in whatever circumstance why it wouldn't work in terms of natural justice. And then we ask, because the legislation states that if that the tribunal has to be held or the hearing has to be scheduled within 15 business days of the notice going out and so on, unless all parties consent. So we put in that cover that the client consents, if the client does in fact, that the client consents to the trial, the hearing being held later than 15 days, but not further away than, say, 30 or whatever is true for the client, so that the tribunal has a little bit more flexibility around the law in providing more than 2 days' notice. And we've had this, after we put one of those letters in, it was the first time we got more than 2 days' notice. And I don't know if that was why, I'm hoping. Second thing is that one client was told he couldn't have an appeal hearing because his notice of appeal wasn't received in Victoria within 7 business days. So we went through the ombudsman, we pushed that, the tribunal talked to their lawyers, and their lawyers said, no, it's the postmark. So we really want to make sure that people know it's the postmark date that counts. And if the tribunal said, we don't have it anymore, we threw the envelope out, the tribunal lawyer said, too bad then. If you don't have the evidence to prove when you got it, it goes in the client's favor and there's an appeal hearing. The third and last is that in that, appeal tribunal members training manual, in the bigger one, I think it's the same draft, I don't know if there's a more recent, but it says it's teaching the tribunal, the appeal hearing members that that policy, that ministry policy, is in fact a reasonable take on law, so that they would be safe in applying ministry policy to decisions. So what we're doing with that, again an experiment, is to go in with our submission, with our argument, acknowledging, just straight out forward, up front, acknowledging what the ministry's policy is on whatever matter, and addressing it and breaking it down fully in our written submission to prove why it's not reasonable in this case, so that the appeal hearing can consider what's in their training manual, but then it's ripped apart and we go in with the rest of our argument.
I'd actually like to hear from Vicky and Soraya, and then after that, Mary. Okay, is that okay?
Just in response to the issue of notice, I know that we're all really struggling with the short-term notice. And initially, my hope was is that because they were new and they didn't have, you know, a heavy caseload to slot tribunals in, that we would see a longer time in between, you know, as time goes along. And I was saying earlier to Vicki that one of the things that we've done, which is maybe a little skanky, but I'm not against doing that sort of stuff, is on the tribunal request form, identifying, having the client identify that they want both a written and oral submission, send it in, it comes back, takes a couple of days, you've got to send it back in. So it's a bit of a game to play. But realistically, yeah, the communication, we need to put the pressure on, I believe, the chair through advocates saying, you know, let's be reasonable about this and keep the pressure on. I think that they will eventually get more appeals in so that they can't book them quite so quickly, and then also having that pressure from us.
I guess I would have to second what Soraya says, but also in some of the more remote areas of the province, which I consider the East Kootenays significantly remote, beyond hope. Anyway, one of the things that is an interesting dynamic is the lack of training that actual ministry people have. And so the day before this tribunal was when the ministry had their so-called training. I'm not sure who does the training. So frequently they don't even know. And so, for instance, one acting DS really, really tried to tell me that a written submission was considered new evidence, needed to argue that. Another tribunal was held almost in Alberta, and it was a married couple that it was excess assets was what the ministry was saying. I didn't find out about it until afterwards. And actually, the because the file was in the husband's name, he was allowed to go before the panel. She was not, because the file was not in her name. Okay, pretty lousy stuff. Anyway, and one other point is, I don't know if you're finding this in the recons, but man, those workers look through every piece and every section of the legislation that they can put on the recon, so that you have to argue in the recon all kinds. Like the last one I did, there was 9 different sections of legislation and only 2 really applied. But I felt like I needed to argue them all, you know, to prepare for the tribunal and for judicial review. So there's those kinds of games that are being played as well that you need to watch out for.
Some other concerns I have is even in the notice itself, since this is supposed to be an accessible process, the fact that Brian Gifford is not accessible, there is no phone number that the client or the appellant can reach them if there is a problem with attending the tribunal date. And even the delivery mechanism itself, I recently had a client that was being released from hospital, and I was starting to wonder, you know, where's his notice, because we do know it's a shorter time frame now. And, you know, had he been in the hospital and missed his tribunal, then what and how is that going to be dealt with? And not having or being excluded from the process now as an advocate, you know, sitting and basically waiting to hear from the client. And I think that it is going to turn a lot of clients away if they miss their tribunal date. They're going to say, oh, well, I've missed it. I think the process itself is very abusive, just in the fact that they're ordering a person to be there at a certain date at a certain time. To me, what that says is that these people are welfare bums and they have nothing else to do, so they just better be there or forget it. And I find that highly offensive as well. I have a list here, and I've got the mic. One of the things that concerns me that's in the training manual is the panel being able to consult the chair on interpretation, and that applies also to the application of policies. I really question what's happening behind closed doors after we leave a tribunal. And I find that highly disturbing, and I think something as a group that we have to look at. There's so many. Can you narrow it down? The panel came out five minutes later. Yeah. The explanation they provided is that the chair has to do all the written work. But yeah, we walked out of a tribunal Wednesday, and within 5 minutes, two of the panel members came out. And for those of us who were familiar with the previous way of doing things, they were often in there for an hour discussing and writing the decision. So it seems to me the responsibility is now left to the chair, and what that's going to get you, you know, remains to be seen. Of course, I don't have the decisions. But I was going to say that that is something that also I find extremely disturbing, is that these individuals who are going before tribunal boards, it's taking 5, 6, 7 days to get a decision back. And I think that in itself is yet another abusive, you know, treatment of this system, or being treated abusively by it. A lot of people that we're dealing with, mental health consumers, high anxiety levels, and that just adds to it. And I find that extremely disappointing that that's the way they choose to do it. And again, having the chair of the tribunal, having the ability to look over the decision prior to sending it out. Well, is there anything happening in between there if they don't like the decision, or how they've interpreted it, or whatnot? Also, I've gotten a decision back that even the language in it, it said, we support the ministry's decision. And that disturbs me, in that they're not upholding it, they're not confirming it, but they're saying, yeah, generally I think that that's okay. And that's kind of what this is about now, is there enough there to say, yeah, it's reasonable, and that's a little disturbing. I will say, though, that there are some positives that I think we need to also look at. Receiving the evidence package beforehand, I think, is a big benefit. I know I used to get blindsided on occasion in tribunals with new information, even if I had asked for disclosure. So I find that that is a positive. And I had mentioned earlier, ministry is no longer preparing a submission or an argument to the case. I think that that'll eventually be a disadvantage for the ministry, because as we continue to work and put forward our arguments and our rationales, we'll eventually see that I believe will be a disadvantage to them. And I like the idea of going first, actually. I think that it's allows me to lay down the foundation of the case and present my arguments, and the fact that the ministry doesn't argue anything back, I think will in the long term put us up further ahead in the game. So there are some positives. Well, you should be, because that's the way it reads. I think it's in their policy.
No, it's not
isn't it?
Get the last word.
I always get the last word. I offended a ministry representative the other day because I interrupted him. I never do that. That's the other thing, too, that good or bad or indifferent that I've seen in the new tribunals, is the ministry representative is not the is not at all familiar with the case. They're scrambling, like Terrell mentioned, they're scrambling to get into these appeals as well, having a representative there, and I have yet to see the DS of the office doing these cases. It's always been the next in command or down the line.
Mary, do you want to go to the mic? Thanks.
I just did a really fast read of this submission, the argument that had been put in, and one of the cases we're citing tomorrow morning in that judicial review section is the Baker case. And the interesting part about the Baker case, after they went on and made this lovely and glorious quote, they then went on to say that, however, there were times when you had to override the discretionary decisions of the ministerial department. So I think that the Baker case did not decide in the favor of the minister. And the other thing is the Baker case is dealing with the immigration, Ministry of Immigration Department, which I think is accorded an entirely different level of deference. Yeah. So I don't think it's a case that is relevant at all, or it doesn't apply. It's not in their favor.
And that's really great. But for some of us who aren't lawyers and don't have a lot of experience in case law, when I first saw that, I was caught off guard, okay, because I didn't know the Baker case. So now you can be sure that I will know the Baker case. Okay.
Well, I think this is why that whole business of how technical they're going to make these arguments is really important, because you aren't expected to know what the Baker case was. I mean, I didn't know what the Baker case was until I started doing all of this review. But I think the other thing, that if you're faced with something like this, find out, as you say, find out what the Baker case says. You know, any of this stuff, because it's been misinterpreted.
But I think that brings another issue to mind that nobody's really mentioned at all a whole lot these last 2 days, and that's the question of time. You know, I cover an area of several thousand square miles. You know, when do I have time? Mind you, I have to make the time, but I think that's an issue for a lot of lay advocates, you know, is that whole time of doing the legal research. And just for the record, it was a unanimous decision for my client, okay?